This is The View from 22 from The Spectator. Subscribe from just £1 a week at spectator.co.uk.
Welcome to The Spectator podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman, the assistant editor of The Spectator. In this week's episode, we will be discussing the terrorist attacks in Brussels. We will also be looking at whether David Cameron can do anything about the fractures within his party. And finally, we will be debating whether Brexit is a feminist issue. This podcast is sponsored by Berry Brothers and Rudd, The Spectator's house wine. Visit bbr.com to find out more about their cellar plan to help build your wine collection. This week, Brussels became the latest European capital to be attacked by ISIS. Two bombs exploded at the airport and one bomb exploded on the metro. 31 people were killed and many more injured. In the wake of a terrorist attack, everything barely worth saying will be said endlessly. And the only things that are worth saying won't be said, said Douglas Murray, writing for The Spectator yesterday. I'm joined now by Douglas and Haras Rafiq, Managing Director for the Quilliam Foundation, to discuss what kind of response we can expect to see in the wake of these latest attacks. So Douglas Murray, you've described in a blog for The Spectator website this week the predictable response to terror events. What is that?
It goes in several stages. During the first one, lots of people are murdered in cold blood for being on a train or standing at an airport terminal. There's a brief moment of surprise before you go to the second stage, which is people trying to work out a lachrymose response to it that's totally meaningless. For instance, expressing solidarity or praying for the place or calling for other people to pray for the place, all perfectly good things to do in themselves, but now a demonstration of that awful thing, virtue signalling. Governments then come out and condemn it, usually without identifying why it happened. Then you move through a whole set of other phases of denial and avoiding the point. And we're already pretty much in that one. So now producers were phoning people like me and Haras up asking if we could have discussions on liberty versus security or the Apple FBI discussion or where do you fall down? I predict we'll get on to the TPIMS versus control orders ones quite soon when a Labour member of Parliament decides to look tough on this issue by saying how much better it was when we had control orders rather than TPIMS, all of which magnificently manages to continue to avoid any serious discussion. And that's what we're in, and we're deliberately in that, and we will be for a long time to come.
So this isn't sort of the natural stages of grieving. This is actually, you think, an unhelpful way of responding to terrorist attacks.
It's what everyone does now. All sorts of excuses we give, we've all heard them for years. People today are saying it's to do with disenfranchisement, maybe, in Belgium, because the houses these guys lived in weren't as nice as the ones they could live in. Actually, if you look at the Molenbeek houses, most of them are a lot nicer than any house that a well-paid middle-class couple in London can afford to live in. But apparently, if you had such a terrible terrorist Belgian house, you couldn't help but blow yourself up with a suicide vest and take a load of people with you. It's things like that. We just come up with excuses, which the terrorists never ask for. They say why they do it, but nobody listens to them. It must be very irritating for them.
And Haras, is that true that actually it is nothing to do with dissatisfaction with life circumstances or deprivation or anything like that? These are all just trite points that are being made by broadcasters. Or is there an element of truth in there?
Look, at the end of the day, there are elements of grievances. There are elements that people do have. But then there are a number of us sitting here, three of us sitting here today. By the time when we go home tonight in our own beds and we lie down, we will all have grievances that we will think of, and my grievance will be much greater than yours and Douglas's. And why aren't I a jihadist? Why aren't I going killing people? I think that there are too many people that focus on this area. And Douglas is right. I mean, one of the things I'm really, really fed up with, and I've been doing this work now for about 11 years, is having to have the same conversations again and again and again to say, well, is it disenfranchisement? Is it some lack of integration? Is it somebody can't get a job? Is it somebody who's not educated?
Is it Belgian foreign policy?
Is it Belgian foreign policy? Well, you know, on the foreign policy thing, I will concede to anybody that it's foreign policy. If they can explain to me why Belgian or British foreign policy, how that can inspire British or Belgian Muslims to travel thousands of miles and kill other Muslims and take Yazidi sex slaves. Mm. It just doesn't make sense. And it's so annoying and frustrating. It's the ideology. Mm. Something is taking some of these people who may have some of these problems. Of course, everybody has problems. and turns them into jihadists. That's the debate, that's the discussion. And if we don't have that debate, everything else is just useless rhetoric.
And the absence of that debate presumably means that the government finds that there's more pressure to target the things that aren't actually a problem. You say in your piece that when officials are saying that they are doing all they can, you don't seem fully convinced by those lines.
Well, they're not. I was on a primetime BBC political programme only a few months ago when there was a minister who was sat there and he was saying, you know, we need to better understand the root causes of radicalisation and terrorism. And I just turned around to him and said, well, we know what they are. We'd established what they were more than 10 years ago. Mm. And I think there's a huge element of politicking. There's huge elements of both social politicking and politicking for votes and everything else that we have these politicians doing. I think there is a denial, and I think there's a symbiotic relationship forming now between, on the one hand, what we call the regressive left, the far left, who live in denial and empower Islamist ideology. Whoops, there I said it, Islamist ideology. They will empower this ideology as being normative Islam, and in some case areas, in some parts of the world, it is. Then we have the nationalistic, populistic people who will say it's all Muslims and all Islam. Somewhere in the middle is the solution, and I think it's people's inabilities and lack of willingness to actually get into that middle, get into the nuance and tackle these issues head on.
Douglas, what would you expect ministers to be doing in the next few weeks as they respond to what's happened in Brussels, as they prepare for a potential attack on British soil?
Other than praying for the victims.
Yeah, and
hashtags.
And putting together Cobra meetings and grandstanding about the exciting fact that you're doing a Cobra meeting. Look, I mean, everyone's on high alert. Belgium was on high alert. But the moment that the bombs went off, Paris is still in a state, France is still in a state of emergency. I mean, months and months after the last attacks there. So this is normal. So the question to my mind is there anything different they're going to do? And the answer to that is no. There's nothing different they're going to do. It's going to go round and round the same thing, which leads to the next question, really, to my mind, which is what would it take to make them do something? The grim truth is, and it's only just over 24 hours since people were killed. But the grim truth of it is that 3 dozen people being killed in Brussels is not enough to make the British government do anything. 130 people in Paris is not enough for the British government to do anything. But, you know, consider the following thought experiment. America lost 3,000 people in one day on 9/11. Now, airport security, I think most people agree, if you have to, that among the airport security measures most countries have put in place, that Israel, for instance, has to put in place because of airline hijackings in the past, is some element of profiling. Now, of course, profiling walks against a whole set of things in American civil society that make people very nervous, and without some understandable reasons. So 3,000 people being killed in one day wasn't enough to change American attitudes towards profiling at airports. So how many thousands of people does it take? I think a lot. And unfortunately for all of us, we will be able to see that experiment play out in the coming months and years.
Do you know what's I find really disturbing? We're living in a time where the reality is that there is a global jihadist insurgency. We know what these guys are doing. They've told us what they want to do. They've told us their tactics. 10 years ago, al-Suri, the al-Qaeda ideologue, told and called for an insurgency in Europe. ISIS, Daesh, ISIL, whatever the current word is, Islamic State is what they call themselves, have told us that they want to take us out of the grey zones. They told us what their tactics are. Why are we taking so long to respond? Why are we as a... And it's not just the government, it's people, it's civil society as well. Why is there this sometimes almost political correctness around, ooh, we're not going to touch this area of debate, this issue, because, ooh, we might be deemed as being bigoted. That's the real elephant in the room. People are afraid to talk about issues that affect us all. Muslim or non-Muslim, I don't care. I'm British. My children, Ankara, in Istanbul, my son and his wife were in Istanbul in the very place where the bomb went off a week before it did. It could have been there. I want to take these issues head on. I want to tackle them. I know Douglas does, and I know most of us sitting here do. But there's still this refusal within polite society to actually get right into the heart of the debate.
So much easier to throw in a googly, talk about foreign policy, talk about Israel-Palestine, talk about anything else other than talking about what Harris has just described.
And in terms of the response to the new trend of terrorism that you describe in your piece, which is terrorist cells embedding themselves within large populations, it is frightening for lots of people, isn't it? But is there any way that governments can change to adapt to those cells being developed?
First of all, it is frightening. It's frightening for me, and it's frightening for everybody. It should be. And as Douglas said, perhaps the fright level isn't enough for people to do something.
The more troubling thing, which the Molenbeek and Belgian story in general raises, is how is it possible that this young man was able to hide in this area? A lot of people must have known he was there, at least a number. Yeah. And why, when the police, when the security forces in Belgium came to arrest him on Friday, were there riots from local Muslim youths at a terrorist who killed 130 people in Paris being arrested? That is the much bigger problem. And that is one that our governments are nowhere near solving. And that is what they should be addressing. The security services are dealing with the first ones. The government needs to deal with the second. And this government in Britain is nowhere near it.
That was Douglas Murray and Harris Rafiq. Now on to the great Tory split. In this week's cover story, James Forsyth looks at the Conservative crack-up. No one does political violence quite like the Tories, and the past week has been particularly vicious after Ian Duncan-Smith resigned from his position as Work and Pensions Secretary. James joins me now with our editor Fraser Nelson to discuss whether Cameron can restore peace within his party. So James, is the Conservative Party in a terrible mess?
I think the Conservative Party is in some trouble, and that's been masked by Labour's incompetence. You know, David Cameron got through PMQs very easily because the Labour Party is in an even worse state than the Tory Party. But you can't underestimate a former Tory leader walking out of the government saying that the government is in danger of dividing society. I mean, that is quite a big moment in politics. If we had a half-competent opposition, this would be a lot worse for the Conservatives, but it is still pretty bad.
Fraser, have you been surprised by how angry the mood has been, or do you think this week actually the mood has been quite good in the party, all things considered?
I've been surprised at the anger given the scale of the government's accomplishments. I mean, one of the strange things about this government is record on social justice is pretty impressive. If you look at the number of jobs created, inequality has gone down. And this isn't just Ian Duncan-Smith's work. It's the result also of the Treasury and their raising the tax threshold. And it should be a Conservative-wide success story. And I'm surprised at how Ian Duncan-Smith's resignation has led quite a few Tories to lose sight of this and somehow think, as if he's talking nonsense, as if the social justice agenda was fraudulent from the off. And I never cease to be amazed, other than always surprised, at the Conservative Party's ability to fight itself. Tories have got a taste for each other's blood, and I think we've been reminded of that this week. I mean, David Cameron's done a pretty good job keeping the lid on these tensions, and he has been trying to make up. I think he's been conciliatory in the last few days, but certain elements of his party are just itching for a more gloves-off fight with each other.
Have we learnt more about David Cameron this week in the way that he's responded to this resignation, James?
Well, Friday night, his reply to Ian Duncan-Smith's resignation letter was a big mistake, because rather than being the statesman, he basically entered into the spirit of this barroom brawl, saying that he was puzzled by IDS's decision to quit, kind of going through a series of events that was designed to portray IDS in the least favourable light possible, and then, just in case anyone had missed, you know, shoehorning in a reference to Europe at the end of the letter to say, you know, in not so subtle code, yeah, I reckon this is all really about Europe rather than disability benefits. But since then, I think cooler heads have prevailed. He was in very conciliatory form on Monday, and he was in conciliatory form again today, and I think that has soothed tensions.
So he's been taking advice from others who said you need to cool it. It's not him necessarily.
He has, after a kind of Friday night rage, I think he has now calmed down and has realised that whatever his own personal feelings towards people, he needs to take some of the heat out of his situation. But the big question for him is he has been more conciliatory on the Europe question in the Commons chamber. He has not said things that would provoke Tory backbenchers. The big question is, can he take that new slightly more conciliatory style out on the campaign trail with him? Or as soon as he returns after his Easter break and hits the stump for the referendum campaign again, will it be back to the same slightly contemptuous tone about those who want to leave?
Fraser, this is going to get worse, isn't it? We're only in March. We've got until June the 23rd for this to rumble on. How on earth is everyone going to get on for that long?
Well, yes, it is going to get worse. I mean, I think this is so damaging for the Conservatives because the same faces that oppose each other, first of all, it was modernisers versus traditionalists or wets versus dries. The two tribes are now facing each other over the issue of Britain and the EU. And I think that as this goes forward, you're going to see them questioning each other's motives, saying that the other side are basically malign and or don't really get it. And you can already see in some of the returning fire to Ian Duncan-Smith, the notion that he's stupid, he's a little bit crazy, a little bit swivel-eyed. This is what the modernizers have always thought of the other side. Now, as James says in his piece, the Tories fought each other 20 years ago because they were sure of defeat. Now they're fighting each other because they're sure of victory. When they see Jeremy Corbyn across the dispatch box, Jeremy Corbyn, who wasn't able to capitalise on this appalling situation for the Conservative Party, they think to themselves, well, you know, one half of this party could win the election without the other half. So I think this encourages them to try to go for the other side within the party because they're not very worried about the effect. I think David Cameron is worried. But I think the rest of them think, well, you know, this is actually a very good time to have this fight because Labour has given the Tories permission to behave pretty badly and still win the election.
Labour shows no signs at all of being able to get its act together, does it? This week, Jeremy Corbyn seems to have missed about five open goals in the Commons.
It is almost offensive how bad the Labour Party is at this job of opposing the government. You know, I thought it's amazing that Jeremy Corbyn hasn't done the most basic thing, which is to read out huge chunks of Ian Duncan-Smith's resignation letter and just put them to David Cameron. They also haven't goaded George Osborne into disputing IDS's version of the events surrounding his resignation that would have brought, you know, a counterblast from IDS. I was just talking to a Tory minister now and he said, I think this is going to only be a 3-day story when there was really enough material here for this for the run for 10 days. I mean, Corbyn has not done any of the role that the leader of the opposition should do in stoking the Tories' troubles over this. But I think one of the things that we cannot ignore, which is a massive contributory factor to IDS's resignation, is the way in which the government is run. It is essentially run out of number 10 and 11 Downing Street. You know, David Cameron and George Osborne are both former central office staffers. They believe in a strong centre. They want ministers to do what they're told to do. One of the clashes here was that IDS very much had his own agenda. And I think he speaks for more people in the cabinet than just himself when he basically complains that the cabinet have been treated as ciphers.
One of the things that jumped out at me in James's cover piece was saying how last Sunday, when Ian Duncan-Smith and David Laws were on the sofa together in Andrew Marr's show, that IDS said to David Laws, you know, we really miss the Liberal Democrats. Never thought I'd say this, but it was better with you guys in government. Now, what he meant was that during the coalition era, David Cameron was always trying to build bridges, make sure everybody got along with each other, not just Tories and Lib Dems, but individual Tory ministers. There was more of a balance and it felt a bit more like cabinet government. Now there's a majority. The Tory majority has turned fairly quickly into a Tory duopoly, with Cameron and Osborne running it, and the rest of the cabinet feeling as if they're being just issued orders all the time. So ironically, they feel less influential over the government's affairs now with the Tory majority than they did during the coalition days.
And James, you've got such an intriguing and amusing line in your column that David Cameron has been distracted by Europe, which I never thought I'd read from the Prime Minister who claimed that his party should stop banging on about Europe. What's happened to him?
Number 10's emotional and intellectual energy is all been channeled into this referendum campaign. I think this means that Number 10 weren't quick enough to spot that a budget with worsening fiscal forecasts was going to bring out all the tensions in the institutional relationship between the Treasury and the GWP and the personal relationship between Ian Duncan-Smith and George Osborne. I think if Number 10 had intervened earlier, they could have stopped this bust-up from going nuclear.
Fraser, do you expect any more resignations?
Not immediately, I don't think. I mean, I think the Tories will be relatively... I think they looked over the cliff edge in the last few days and they've still got enough preservation instinct, I think, for the Prime Minister to pull them back. But after... I think they're going to wait and fight it out during the referendum campaign. After that's over, I expect the vengeance to arrive.
That was James Forsyth and Fraser Nelson on the Conservative row. And a quick reminder of our special subscription offer just for listeners of The View from 22. For just £22, you can receive a 22-week subscription to The Spectator in the post, along with access to our website, iPad, iPhone and Android apps. Sign up to read all the articles discussed in this podcast at spectator.co.uk/22. And finally, should feminists back Brexit? In this week's magazine, Julie Birchall says that Britain is trapped in a bad marriage with the EU. Any feminist worth her salt would see that and vote to leave, she argues. I'm now joined by Caroline Lucas, the Green Party MP for Brighton Pavilion, who is campaigning for Britain to stay in the European Union, and Anne Cremin, who works for Liberal Leave and Women for Britain and wants Britain to leave. So Anne, you are a feminist and you're campaigning for Britain to leave the European Union. Are the two connected?
Yeah, I think they are really. Well, women, as all people really, but women need to have a strong say in who rules over us and how we are governed. And I think the EU directly goes against this. Legislation which affects every citizen in the EU is written and proposed by unelected officials in the Commission, comparatively limited power allocated to the European Parliament, and particularly as a Lib Dem as well. I think it's quite a traditional concern of ours that people have the opportunity to engage with the legislative process. You know, we always attack the House of Lords for its absence of democracy, and yet we turn a blind eye to the way that the more powerful and equally unelected institutions of the EU acquire more and more control over our lives.
So is it the case that you, if you are a feminist, you can only campaign for Brexit, or can you see both sides of the argument?
Yeah, I can see, but I think a lot of the arguments on the other side are slightly disingenuous. I get really angry. The one thing that really bothers me on the other side is the presentation of the EU as a liberalising force, and particularly one that benefits women and also LGBT. Things like, I can see on the other side, Britain Stronger in Europe shouting about the tampon tax as if this is some great victory for them. And I like to think most women, at least I'm 20 and I think I'm aware of it, so women older than me probably are as well, we're familiar with these sort of token gestures and aesthetic changes to plaster over difficulties but hide the real issues. And I think... So, and the presentation of the EU as this force which is doing this is profoundly wrong. The UK has had many sort of more liberal measures for women in place long before the EU has.
Caroline Lucas, you are a feminist and you're campaigning for Britain to stay in the European Union. What do you make of Anne's argument?
Well, I certainly think it's possible, obviously, to be a feminist and to campaign to stay inside the EU. And I would say that that is a much better fit than the argument that Anne has been advancing. I mean, first of all, you know, on the issue of democracy, I think that both Westminster and the European Parliament and the European institutions need to have more democracy and transparency. But you could make an equally strong argument to say that at least members of the European Parliament are voted in a system of proportional representation. At least the whipping system isn't so serious when in Brussels. There's much more latitude for people to follow their own views. The Council and our members of the European Parliament are elected democratically. So I challenge the idea that the European institutions are significantly less democratic than Westminster. I think they both need addressing. And on the specific issue of rights for women, of course, I absolutely accept that things like the Equal Pay Act predated the UK joining what was then the EEC. But actually what our membership of the EU has done has expanded and increased those rights. So, for example, under equal pay, it used to simply be equal pay for what they called equal work, in other words, the same work. Actually, as a result of EU legislation, that was changed to equal pay for work of equal value. Now, that made a huge difference to women because it meant, for example, that dinner ladies, to take a stereotype, would get paid the same as dustmen. It was a much more useful piece of legislation. Similarly, with the Pregnancy Workers Directive, again, that has helped strengthen existing rights that happened in the UK. And finally, I think it's really important that when we've got a single market, we absolutely have to have a floor of rights right across the European Union. Otherwise, we have a race to the bottom as governments face what is essentially a perverse incentive to cut back on rights or wages or environmental protection in order to compete for business. So that floor of basic rights is really important right across the EU, not just in the UK alone. And I guess my final point, if I'm looking at the points that Anne raised, I think the tampon tax is more than a token gesture. I mean, it's something that people have been on about for a very long time. And now it does mean that women are not going to be paying over the odds for something that is essentially something that they don't have a choice over buying.
And in this week's magazine, Julie Burchill argues that our membership of the EU is like a bad marriage and the feminist thing to do would be to leave it. Now, Anne, do you not think that actually the point that many people make when marriages are breaking down is that it's important to try and work at them and to try and appreciate what you've got? Or is it the case that actually this is a failed marriage and it's time to get out?
I feel like this has failed by now. It is important to work, and, Caroline's points about our democracy, for example, I know I fully accept that we also have many flaws in Westminster.
Couldn't we improve the EU's democratic credentials?
I think they have, over the years, there have been attempts to try and reform it. The fact that so many, particularly something was telling to me, the fact that so many MEPs are now voting to leave, voting to sort of get themselves out of a job because they don't believe it's reformable. You know, you see in the way that in the past, when countries have disapproved of legislation, they've been asked to do referendums again and again and again to get the people to vote the right way. I think the elite in Europe fundamentally want to see the EU go in a very different direction to what citizens of this country. And if you look at the rise of Eurosceptic parties across the EU, citizens in many countries in Europe want to see it go.
And Caroline Lucas, this debate about feminism and Brexit is hugely important because so many women are undecided in this debate. How do you think the In campaign is or isn't appealing to those undecided female voters at the moment?
Well, I think it's true that on both sides of the debate, there haven't been enough women's voices being heard. And I do welcome the opportunity that you're providing with this podcast. But generally, when women are asked to talk about the referendum, it tends to be framed solely in terms of so-called women's issues. So I really appreciated the fact that when Anne first started out her answer, she was saying, well, hang on a minute, you know, women care about things like jobs and everything else just as men do. It's not just because it's about so-called women's issues. So I think, you know, both sides of the campaign could be doing even more to promote more women's voices. And I think just trying to get away from the tits for tat, you know, on both sides, I think we need to be making a more inspirational case, a more visionary case for the EU. You know, I'm not saying that the EU is perfect, neither is Westminster, but I do think we should stay and reform it. I do think reforms have already started. I mean, for example, each time there is a renegotiation, the Parliament does gain more powers. We do now have far more transparency over corporate lobbying in Brussels than we ever have before, and more transparency, frankly, than we have in the UK. There's a pan-European movement, you know, in many countries around the EU now, talking about the importance of reforming the EU, sometimes just quite simple things like live streaming council meetings, other times, you know, more far-reaching issues like having a stronger focus on environmental and social legislation. But, you know, to me, the bottom line is not that the EU is some kind of elite. I think we shouldn't forget the fact that essentially the EU was born out of a recognition that our continent has had a particularly violent past. It was founded in a sense on recognizing the profound mistakes of Europeans, and it was a very pragmatic response to our failure to manage the disruptive forces of nationalism and industrialization. And I think EU membership has been a powerful driver for peace and stability, and that it is rather remarkable that after centuries of warfare, countries with very different histories and cultures come together. They choose to share some degree of sovereignty while keeping their own identities and traditions in order to work together for the common good. That, I think, is something that we shouldn't take for granted and that would be a huge loss if we were to leave.
That was Caroline Lucas and Anne Kremin. That's it for this week. Thanks for listening.